Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we are a podcast that's dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And thinking seriously, we've tried to endeavor to create and encourage an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. We think there needs to be more opportunities for long-form spaces where you can have conversations with a multitude of people about interesting topics, and they don't always agree with what I think or what other people think, and it's a lot of fun to be able to push back and forth to understand one another as best as we can, but to do so in the proper sort of context. And so lots of fun. We talk to all sorts of people. If you're not, if you're a regular listener, you know this. If you're a brand new listener, we talk about all sorts of topics to all sorts of people, and it's great. In this episode, I've got my friend Dr. Derek King with me, and we're going to be talking about his new book with Cascade that, depending on when you're listening, it drops November 1st, 2024 is the plan anyway, as far as I know. It's called Faith Without Belief, and it is a really fun, short sort of book that I think is really usable for normal people too. Now, I get it that today nobody even reads a single book. Their ability to read, reading comprehension is a Facebook post. But even so, for the most person, most people can handle a 70, 80, 90 page book. I think this is a great fit for just local churches to be engaging in some really important topics. And Derek's done some interesting things in here, so I'm excited to talk about it. So Derek, before we jump into the topic itself, remind your listeners, I know we've talked about Divine Hiddenness, your work there before in the past, but for those who aren't familiar, who are you? What do you do? And then what was it that was like the real motivation to write this book?
Yeah, thanks, Jordan. Thanks for having me on. And first of all, I love the implication that you say this book is for normal people, that the implication there that academics aren't normal, and that certainly tracks. Yeah, so like you said, I've been on before to talk about the work on problem of divine hiddenness. And this book really is a shortened popular version of some of the ideas in that book. Obviously, to give your listeners an idea, I actually just recorded the audiobook last week and it took me about 4 hours. So it's a pretty short book and it's more of a pastoral reflection on some of the themes in the Hiddenness book. And really that was the trajectory of the academic work in the first place, was to think about these issues for the church and how the church might approach some of the issues. And so that's my trying to work this out. So this has been many years coming, I suppose, and I see a natural consequence of some of the previous academic work. It also a particular relationship with a friend throughout the book named Ben, and I changed his name at his request. But some of the conversations we had, a lot of the book and the ideas of the book flow out of there, and thinking about how do I pastorally counsel someone like Ben? What do I have for him? That's in a nutshell where it's coming from.
And I think the story about Ben was helpful. So maybe we can start there to give a little bit of lay of the land. Tell me a little bit about Ben's story and how that fits in with the book.
Good. Yeah. So I mentioned, I did forget to actually answer your question, which is I work at the Lewis House. This is a nice segue. So the Lewis House is a Christian study center on the University of Kentucky campus, and I'm the scholar in residence there, which means this semester especially, I'm really just teaching classes and doing research. So I'm teaching a couple of classes through the Lewis House, which are accredited courses that University of Kentucky students can take and transfer into the UK degree. I also teach a philosophy class for UK. And at the Lewis House one day, Ben just kind of wandered in and was like, hey, what is this place? And we just started talking and got to know each other pretty well. And it became clear pretty fast that Ben was really intelligent. He was an honors student at UK, but he also was really interested in Christian apologetics and theology. He was reading, he said some of his favorite authors were C.S. Lewis and G.K. Chesterton. And so he was pretty deep into that kind of stuff and, you know, was really familiar with the arguments for God's existence. He had grown up nominally as a Christian, but at the time that we met was not a Christian and was sorting through some of these issues, although this had been like several years that he had been reading apologists and thinking through these issues, just enjoyed talking about God, enjoyed talking about theology or philosophy. So yeah, we just kind of met semi-regularly, and he was also in some other Christian communities as well. But we would have conversations about God and arguments for God, but also his doubts that he just wasn't sure. He couldn't say with certainty that God exists and that Jesus rose from the dead. And that was his main hangup. He was like, hey, I see the appeal. This sounds really nice. A lot of my friends are Christians. At the time he was dating a girl who was serious about her faith. So I think you could say Ben really wanted to be a Christian, but just could not get there intellectually and just could not get past his uncertainty, his doubts. So that's really what motivated me in some of these conversations to think about what do I tell Ben? What do I have for him?
Mm-hmm. So one of the things you do in the work is sort of talk about faith, talk about belief. What does it mean to have faith in something? What does it mean to believe in something? Are these two things distinct in any way?
Yeah, of course, just the title alone would suggest that the difference there is kind of at the heart of the book, the difference in faith and belief. So I am hesitant. I tell people what the book is called, I usually follow it up with, it's not as heretical as it sounds, or at least I don't think what I'm suggesting is quite as heretical as it initially sounds, faith without belief. Because I do think that faith in the New Testament does often contain a strong component of belief. So I don't want to just completely separate these two and say there's no relationship whatsoever. But I do want to maybe reorient some of our readings of the New Testament when we come across that word belief, because we see it a lot. You see Jesus talking about belief a lot, or believe in me. And the emphasis of that word is really on faith or trust rather than belief. And so in the Greek, there may not be this same problem, but in English, this word belief can mean a few different things for us. And a lot of the times it just means something like intellectual assent, that I believe that something is true. I believe that Lee Harvey Oswald shot JFK, some example like this. And there's no volitional component. There's no commitment component, no trust involved necessarily. We sometimes use the word belief in that sense. So I believe in my wife, for example. That would be something closer to trust in her. And I actually really like the way that Matthew Bates put it. He has a book called Faith by Allegiance Alone. And I like the word allegiance. I think that is a good word that captures what the New Testament is after when it uses the word. The Greek word is pistis or pisteo is the verb form, that a lot of the times just gets translated in English as belief. And I think that misses some of what we're being asked to do. It's not just accept that all of these propositions are true. There's the real emphasis here is on what we're doing with our hearts, on trusting that Jesus is who he says he is. And that's really the key.
Yeah. So there's, a couple of follow-up questions I have based on that. Maybe we just start with why is it that so many of us seem to experience doubt? And the people I talk to, a lot of them seem to have strong periods of doubt where it's not always like constant, like same level of doubt every day. It seems like there are seasons in which doubt is increased and versus decreased. So what are the main reasons that you've found that are causing that?
Yeah, good. And just as a kind of outline of the book, I do start with arguments for God's existence and for several reasons that I find compelling to believe in God, to believe that Jesus rose from the dead. So I'm not interested in tossing out belief. I just really want to underscore that for your listeners. But yeah, the second chapter, I do turn to why we doubt anyway. So it seems to me there are some really compelling reasons to believe. And if you combine that with people wanting to believe, then why do we doubt? And so I focus in on two reasons. I think there could be several others that we could name that are related to our doubts, but to me, two kind of dominate. One is sin. So that one is universal for all humans and is the more fundamental reason that we are broken and we have separated ourselves from God. And I look at, so of course, again, this kind of worked out of some of my divine hiddenness work and our propensity to see God as hidden. And I point to the early chapters of Genesis that the first problem of hiddenness is not God hiding from humans. It's humans hiding from God. After they sin, Adam and Eve are hiding in the garden from God. And I think too few of us appreciate the role of sin in why we perceive God as hidden or why God isn't more obvious to us. So that's the first reason, and to my mind, the more fundamental one. The second one, though, is more specific to our culture, or maybe you might say just kind of the Western world over the last 50 to 100 years or so. I don't want to say, because every generation has dealt with sin, and that's been part of it. And yet we seem to perceive God as hidden in a way that previous generations didn't, in the way our ancestors maybe didn't. Why is that? And I just call this secularity. So I'm riffing some on Charles Taylor and his work on a secular age. The basic idea is we see God, and I say we again, I mean a kind of Western culture here in general. So this refers to both Western Europe and America, though it wouldn't refer to every part of the world today. But we tend to see the world as less infused with the supernatural than our ancestors did. And I just use the example of when we lived in Scotland for a bit, and we would visit certain places that, like Fairy Glen was an example on the Isle of Skye, where they were just still in the collective memory of the Scots, these areas that are haunted almost by fairies. And I doubt that many modern Scottish people still think of those places as haunted by fairies, because they've also been kind of secularized like we have. But it points to an older way of thinking that did see the world as kind of overlapping with the supernatural. And they were more willing to see, for example, angels and demons being causal agents in the world and God as being involved in the world. But now we just have so another word I kind of appeal to in the book is scientism. So not science, right? Science is a good thing, study the natural world, but scientism, where science is the ultimate explanation for everything and the kind of final arbiter for truth. And that also speaks to, I think, a tendency to see the world as just natural, just physical, material causes. I don't think it has to be this way, though. And it doesn't mean we can just simply flip a switch and we'll see God everywhere. But being aware of the way we've been trained. So like I say it in the book, by both nature and nurture, but by both in nature, we have a sin nature that needs to be redeemed. And in nurture, the way our brains have been trained to see the world and through with a secular lens.
So one question I had is, if we want to make a distinction between faith and belief, does that allow us to say faith could be blind in any sense, where all the stuff that I know or I believe is completely contrary to the faith that I have?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we would probably need to get, you know, really down into the details for what does it mean for faith to be blind. But I certainly think you can have good reasons for having faith in something without full belief in it or something. Because like you mentioned, whether it be doubt or whether it be faith or belief, we often think of these as on a spectrum of some sort. Like maybe belief is binary, that I either believe something or I don't. But it seems to me that at least my confidence in beliefs in certain things is different. So the example I use in the book, at the time of writing the book, I was, okay, I believe that my computer is sitting in front of me right now. And I also believe that Dover is the capital of Delaware. But I would say, you know, I'm not so good with capitals. And so I was like, I'm not positive of that. I actually had to go look it up to confirm that was indeed correct. You know, I might have put 60% or 70% sure about that. So I think our beliefs and faith can work similar to that, that I can still have really good reasons to think that something is the case without being certain of it, and that might motivate my faith.
Yeah. So thinking of faith in terms of like allegiance, there's some of me that like, I like that. And then there's the other part of me that thinks of some of the more Reformed confessions and the way they sort of articulate faith as sort of the more of the accepting or resting sort of idea, receiving. Are those two things compatible, those sort of definitions? And if you took that other sort of way of articulating faith, does that then cause any sort of difference for how we would understand the relationship between faith and belief?
Yeah, I would need to look at those Reformed confessions a little closer to see if I thought there was any rub, but I suspect not. I think I like the allegiance. Just, I think what I like about the word allegiance is the way, again, it just kind of reshapes or reorients how we typically think of belief. So again, that's really the kind of concern I have here is that translational move to translate pistis or pisteo just as belief kind of waters down what's really at stake here, which is where is our hearts? What are we directed toward? What do we love? What do we value? And I think that you could add, what do we rest in, or where is kind of our final ultimate hope? There are a lot of different ways to talk about that, to talk about faith. I just want to kind of say that's really the emphasis. That's really what Jesus is after. He's after the state of our hearts and where those are oriented and directed, not necessarily what's in our heads. And that's not, again, not to say that that doesn't matter. What's in our heads is irrelevant. Just to say what's, as one of my seminary professors used to say, we have to put the emphasis on the right syllable. And putting the emphasis on the right syllable here looks like directing us toward faith, trust, allegiance, resting in God. A lot of different ways to talk about that, but
yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes sense. And I know the text in John, I believe help my unbelief has always been very helpful for me personally, but I think a really important sort of text for this idea. So when he says, I believe help my unbelief, how does that sort of like fit within the way you were explaining it?
Yeah, that's the story, the gospel story that I anchor this idea in the most probably is the man who, just some of the context of the story, his son is has an unclean spirit or a demon, and he's clearly tried everything. He's a frantic father, and he goes to Jesus' disciples and Jesus and just is, of course, at this point, willing to try everything, but there's still this kind of uncertainty about, is this going to work, right? He says to Jesus, hey, if you can heal my son, and it's something that Jesus even calls out. He says, if I can heal him, of course I can heal him. And so there's this kind of uncertainty in the man, and his confession is, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief, and it's the same word there. I think the dynamic is, so Augustine looks at this passage and he says, he's talking just about the man recognizes he has faith, but it's his faith is just a little bit too weak. And that I think is, yeah, a plausible explanation and a way to explain it. But the fact that they're so close together that he says, I both have faith and I don't have faith, is the only time in the New Testament I could find where you have both belief and unbelief set aside one another like this. And to me, the most plausible way to read it is the man saying, I'm still not sure about this, and I'm not certain this is going to work out, but yeah, I'm just going to trust. I'm just going to trust that you are who you say you are, even despite my uncertainty. And I recognize even that in confessing my unbelief is an act of belief, right? Is an act of trust. To say, help thou my unbelief, help me believe, is itself an expression of his trust in Jesus, and that Jesus might be able to do something for him.
Yeah, that's good. I'm reminded of, I think it's a Spurgeon quote where he says something along the lines of, you know, I'm not saved by a strong faith, but a strong Savior. And that was always something that sort of anchored me, especially in my college days when I was really struggling with belief in some ways. One of the last chapters you have, I think it may be the last full chapter, I really want to spend some time discussing the idea of, can a Christian really be described as a non-believer in some sense? Because I think that's probably provocative, intentionally so. So walk me through the idea there behind that.
Yeah. So I do in chapter two, try to lay, I guess, some, this academic terminology, but lay some conceptual groundwork for these different terms, what I mean by non-belief. And I really have in mind, when I say a non-believer, I really have in mind two different kinds of people. Like, one would be someone that lacks belief in God. And this is importantly distinct from someone who disbelieves in God, right? So it's not like my friend Ben, he even though he couldn't say, I believe that God exists and that Jesus rose from the dead, he also wasn't saying, I believe God doesn't exist and I believe Jesus didn't rise from the dead, right? So there's not, that would have been disbelief. So he more just kind of lacks this belief. So I have in mind that person, the person who maybe wants to be a Christian, but just can't because of some intellectual barriers, genuine intellectual barriers. And I also have in mind someone that we probably would call a Christian, say they go to church regularly, but that their doubts are so severe and so regular that they really threaten their Christianity in some way, right? So maybe they're considering leaving the church because of this, or they can't honestly confess, for example, the Apostles' Creed. They couldn't just say, I believe in all of these, in all of these different propositions, with, again, kind of anything approaching full certainty. Maybe there's still something there that they do believe, or some of it they can latch onto. But so that's really what the two people I have in mind, two class of people I have in mind. So I'm fine not calling that second category, if we want to say someone that is in the church, I'm fine not calling them a non-believer, but I think they still kind of qualify for the kind of person I'm after here, which is someone that just in one way or the other lacks these beliefs. And again, I'm happy to also just call this severe doubt, which I do it several times in the book as well. So not just, we all have doubts from time to time, right? Maybe just occasionally just kind of lingering doubts, but for a lot of us, it may not affect how we interact with our faith at all. It may just be, I woke up this morning feeling some doubts and now I feel better. But for some people, as you mentioned, it can get pretty severe. And even my own life, I've walked through more severe periods of doubt where I don't know if I could fully confess, but in other periods, it's much less severe. So mostly the severe, when I say non-believer, I have in mind the severe doubter and that kind of category of, I guess, genuine, honest, agnostic, something like that.
So if you're thinking pastorally about these sorts of people, how would you encourage pastors or others functioning in those sort of roles to engage people who have these sorts of doubts and feelings?
Yeah, good. So I'm actually eager to hear, as someone that's in a little bit more of an academic role, but still has kind of one foot in ministry, one foot in academia, I'm really eager to hear other pastors talk about this. I've obviously talked to some pastors about it and how do we approach a situation like Ben's, but that was really, as we were talking, what I'd ask pastors to do is put themselves in this position where you've got a parishioner who is clearly, maybe really genuinely wants to be a Christian, but has just some intellectual hangups that are pretty severe. Again, they have some doubts. They have some uncertainty about it all, about the Christian story. And there's a lot of things we would counsel them at first. We'd say, you should read scripture. You should start praying consistently. You should be in Christian community. You should maybe read apologetics, right? And you would want to meet with them and talk through some of the arguments for God's existence, Jesus' resurrection, maybe even something like imaginative apologetics, where you'd want to make the Christian story more compelling. I think all of those are great things, and that's what I would encourage people to do. What I see, the path I'm laying out here, you might even say is kind of like a last resort. It's kind of like, hey, maybe you've tried these things and you still just aren't sure. Like, you can't, and I use Ben's story and compare him to a movie it's called The Seventh Seal, where there's a medieval knight returning home from the Crusades. It's a really old movie where this medieval knight's playing death in chess. So yeah, it's that kind of movie. Pretty slow and obscure, but I really liked it because it deals with these themes in a pretty heavy-handed way. But the knight just craves certainty. And I think he's a really good picture, which is kind of ironic because he's a medieval knight, but the movie's, of course, from the 50s. So it's the knight is so modern in his doubt. He just craves certainty, craves knowledge, and God's hiddenness is really troubling to him. And for someone that just craves that certainty, I think there's going to be a lot of people that fall into this camp of, I need to be certain about it before I can commit. And if all of the apologetics arguments don't work, and if they're being involved in a Christian community doesn't work, what do we tell them? And it seems to me, I can tell them that you can still trust Jesus. You may not be certain about this, but I think how I put it in the book is having a disposition of hope, just a hope that Jesus is who he says he is. Commit to Jesus, commit to his church, and I think things will work out well for you in the end. Those who seek find. It may not happen on the timeline that we would like or that we hope. And I do think that if someone kind of committed to a Christian life and committed to, again, Christ's church, I do think that would ultimately lead in a personal belief, but I can't be sure of that. I can't give that person a guarantee. So I use the analogy here also of arranged marriages is, I think, at least gives us something in our world to kind of to show how this might work for the non-believer. When in an arranged marriage, you can't have any of those warm, fuzzy feelings before. Let's say you haven't met the person until the wedding day. What I've found in some of the research here was that actually arranged marriages are far more likely to work out, or to not, at least to not end in divorce, than non-arranged marriages. Now, there are some other reasons for that, but I do think it at least shows us that we can imagine a relationship like this that is commitment forward, that starts with commitment instead of what all that we're used to. So it requires kind of a cultural reorientation to think about this. But instead of thinking, I'm certain that this is my soulmate and I know that we're compatible and all this, but still from starting from the commitment, you can still find a successful marriage, successful relationship. I think faith without belief would be something like that, that it starts with the commitment, that maybe you're not sure and you're still kind of uncertain, but I don't think that means you can't participate in the life of the church, or I don't think it means that you can't have faith in some kind of qualified sense. It may not be a full, robust, ideal, glorified faith that we all seek, but none of us have that, and none of us are fully there. So that's the path that I want to lay forward, to say as almost a concession to our secular age, and recognizing for all the people out there that crave that certainty, maybe you don't have to have that. Maybe you don't have to have the certainty. You can start with faith and seek understanding.
So you've said a lot of really interesting and helpful things here. And there's like four separate questions that I have based on this. One of them is, if we were to describe what is saving faith fundamentally, and I know it can still be a fuzzy concept because you're like, well, there's still some vagueness around the corners and edges of this to where you can't really nail it down exactly. But like, what's the core of what saving faith is?
Yeah, I'm really thankful I don't have to decide who's saved and who isn't, right? That's something I'm just eternally grateful for. Yeah, you mentioned I really like that Spurgeon quote. I'd not heard that, but that we're not saved by, what was it? We're not saved by a great faith, by a great savior. Is that right?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I mean, I do. Obviously, we can look in scripture and have some marks of what is a saving faith. But Jesus himself says there's going to be surprises when we get to the end, and I can't know a person's heart. So can faith that belief be saving faith? I think it can. I think someone that is committed and that genuinely wants. So I also think of the Merton quote, the prayer, right, that he says, now I'm going to butcher it, but it's something to the effect of, I'm not sure that I want you, but I want to want you. That kind of second order desire is, I recognize this failing in me, but I still want this. And I think that can be enough. And it is kind of a concession to our weakness that Jesus meets us where we are. And if we are willing to take that step and genuinely seek, again, those who seek find, those who ask, the door is open. If someone is asking, if someone is genuinely seeking, I don't think God will turn them away. And I can't be sure that that's going to end in the kind of certain belief that we all associate with, that we mostly sometimes associate with Christianity. But I think it can be.
Yeah. So this reminds me a little bit of a podcast from the Mere Orthodoxy guys a while back on sort of like I think they were arguing for the goods of nominal Christianity and sort of gave an example, and I'm going to probably butcher the example, but I think of it as somebody who regularly attends church and yet is committed committed to continuing to live in sexual sin and is aware of that and knows that and just says, I can't help it. Mm-hmm. And yet continues to regularly attend church. Is there a sense in which you'd say, you know what, even though you theoretically want to believe it, there's still this type of sin that is prohibiting you from having true faith in this sense. So it's not merely just like intellectual struggles. It's more of like an actual volitional, I am actively living in disobedience to what I know is inherently the case for the Christian faith.
Yeah. So just to be clear, you're saying that maybe like non-belief is a recognition of our sin or weakness or something?
Maybe.
Like that.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm just trying to think through some different scenarios and examples.
Yeah, no, I think that's a pretty good example of maybe how pastorally we would want to counsel someone like that. I don't know. I hadn't really thought much about whether non-belief is necessarily the result of, say, intellectual sin. And I think of that bit in The Great Divorce as well, where Lewis says, do you think there's no sins of intellect? And I tend to think that there are. I don't know exactly what this would look like, or I'm not committed to the view that every non-believer is necessarily committing a sin of the intellect. But as I mentioned, I think non-belief is ultimately like connected with sin, that's the root of it. And yeah, any non-belief is in part because of sin. So I think that still would be a helpful category. I would maybe want to resist the conclusion that any non-believer is in that state because of some specific personal sin in their life.
Yeah. That makes sense. So I'm also wondering the way you sort of like the advice you gave here, commit yourself to a church, sort of like the arranged marriage sort of example. Does that have more, it seems to have more purchase power for more traditional magisterial Protestant sort of denominations that would also include infant baptism, to where that sort of framework, it seems like if you already think of infant baptism as an appropriate mode, then you're already sort of like naturally saying like, yes, you should belong in some sense before you believe and you'll eventually get there. Whereas the more voluntary sort of church associations where you're baptized upon your belief, it seems to be probably more of a difficult sort of framework to think through when it comes to faith and doubt. Do you think that is an appropriate sort of an ecclesiological, I don't know, dividing line to think about this topic?
There is at the end, which I'll get to in a minute, a particular ecclesiological move that I want to make. I don't think is necessary for the whole argument, but I don't think of it quite like that. I mean, I do come from the Anglican tradition, so maybe it's the ecclesial imagination has been shaped in such a way where this makes sense to me that may not to other people. But I did grow up Southern Baptist. My dad's still a Southern Baptist minister. I would be curious to hear from those that are in the voluntary association camp if you thought how you would maybe pastorally guide someone who is in this situation, someone like Ben that has clearly tried out all the arguments and is, wants to be a Christian, but finds these intellectual barriers insurmountable. I don't know what else to tell him. Do I just say I guess you could say keep trying and we could do that for a while. But if he tries that for 20 years, like at some point, or do you just say, sorry, I guess Christianity isn't for you, or you're not one of the elect? I mean, I don't, to my mind, the pastoral response there is still participation in the church. Yeah. And that can plausibly end in commitment if he's willing to make that kind of long-range, long-term commitment. I do make a turn at the end. I can stop there, or do you want me to go into that kind of final turn?
Go into the final turn, and we'll come back to this if we have time.
Okay, yeah. So the very last section of the last chapter, I call faith with belief. And this probably does require at least some ecclesial It certainly is. There's an ecclesiology in mind here, but I'm not sure I would restrict it to only certain traditions, but I can at least try it out and see if anyone's interested in it. But I say it's faith with belief. And I'm thinking here of, there's a little bit, the little Apostles' Creed book written by Ben Myers, is a really nice just meditation on the different, I guess, propositions of the creed. And one of my favorite chapters was on just the first word of the creed, I believe, right? And I think as contemporary individual Americans, we think of that in a very individual frame, that when we say, I believe, we are all individually saying the creed together. But Myers argues that actually what that's doing there is it's Jesus saying the I. And as the church, as the body of Christ, we are collectively saying it as one body, as the church. And so the I there is not just me as an individual confessing this, making this statement, but the church is saying it on our behalf. And I use the example of just because, you know, again, this is not something in which we can't look at contemporary examples that we can make sense of this, like something like representative democracy, right? That we elect representatives that act on our behalf, such that I can say, you know, Kentucky is for less gun control or more gun control or whatever, like Kentucky did or said this, even though that clearly does not represent every individual in Kentucky, because there's a representative that acts on our behalf, but which it still makes sense to think of us as a group and as kind of one collective agent, you might say. And so I kind of flush this out ecclesiologically with the church and say, if the church is really the body of Christ and it's Christ, it's confessing the Apostles' Creed, it's making these confessions on our behalf, then I think there's a sense in which a non-believer can really say the creed and say, I believe, and be almost caught up in the beliefs of the church. If, again, they're committed to the church, committed to Christ, and are fully part of that body through baptism. So it's not just to say, well, anybody that stumbles in off the street and happens to say the Apostles' Creed that day, that Sunday, well, then now they're a full believer in that because of they're kind of caught up in this confession. But just in the commitment to the church, if you're part of this church, there's a sense in which the church believes on your behalf. And to me, that's an enormous comfort as well, because there are times when most Sundays I can go in church and I can say the Apostles' Creed and fully mean it and have that full just full confession, full certainty. But as you mentioned, that we all have these doubts, and there may be some days in which I need the church a little bit more to confess for me. So I think this is a really beautiful picture of how these confessions work and how our membership in the church is intricately related to our own confessions of belief.
Yeah, no, that's really good advice. And I found that to be similar sort of movements for me. You know, on the Sundays where you feel like you can't say it, the church is almost saying it for you in some senses and carrying you along. So as I think of the example of Ben, tell me what you think here. So like, if I have somebody like that coming to my church, says like, I've got all these intellectual objections and I can't believe, I'd say like, I want you to attend. I want you to participate in the life as much as you can. I'm not gonna let you be a member yet, because you're not, you know, claiming that you're a Christian in any sense. You know, in a sense, you say you're interested and you want to be, but you're not there. And then, you know, as I get to know him, I'd want to understand more. What exactly are these objections? Because if the objection turns out of, you know, I'm living in all these different sins, and I just don't want to give those up, that seems to be a different conversation than I really just genuinely have a hard time getting around these sort of like intellectual problems. Like, I can't see God. Like, how is that? How does that work? How do all these other things work? And if it was truly genuinely just those sort of like, I just need certainty, I'd say, okay, it's time to just, you're not going to have certainty. I think you need to commit and, you know, have this sort of just this trust in those, in the way you've described it. Whereas it's different if the reason that they have these obstacles is more of a, like, I have sins that I want to continue to live in. like actual, like not just intellectual sins, but actual, like maybe I want to steal from my employer, embezzle money, or I want to do these things regularly and I know they're wrong. I just want to continue to do them. I know if I commit to the faith, then I have to stop doing them. That seems to be a relevant distinction for me in that sort of scenario.
Good. Yeah. So I think what's important here and what you're maybe pushing in on is this advice clearly needs to be contextualized and needs to be done with a pastor. I'm not saying that the next time you have someone come to your office and say, hey, I'm kind of interested in this Christianity thing, but I'm not sure about it. The answer is not just, okay, well, we'll just get you baptized and you'll just be, you know, full-fledged member of the church. That's not the advice. This is, again, more, I see this as kind of more of a last ditch effort of a, hey, you've really tried some things and he's not getting to that kind of full certainty. And like you mentioned, we may never, like none of us may never get to that kind of full certainty on a kind of scientific framework, right? Where we need this kind of empirical proof of God or something like that. So that clearly should not be the objection that keeps you from the faith. But yeah, clearly, even if someone is an honest seeker, you might say, or a genuine agnostic, there of course still might be other sins in their life that are keeping them from this commitment. And that needs to be worked out with a pastor on some sort of regular long-term basis. So this is just more of a reflection of, and it is kind of a specific situation, but I suspect because we haven't really thought of this as a live option, there may be more people out there that would fall into this bucket than we may initially think of someone that really is interested in the faith and even would be willing to live in accordance with Christian teaching and ethics, but just finds intellectually it difficult, like it too large of a hump to get over. And I just don't want that to be the reason people can't commit to the church or to Christ.
Yeah, no, that's good. So as far as like further reading or resources that you generally recommend related to the topic, what would those be?
Yeah, good question. I actually have at the end of the book a further reading section that's kind of annotated that breaks into academic books and popular level books as well. There are obviously a lot of different directions to go. I mean, some of this you probably recognize the emphasis on desire or the heart over what's going on in our head would kind of naturally lines up with some of Jamie Smith's work in something like You Are What You Love, but also his little summary of Charles Taylor's A Secular Age, How Not to Be Secular, introduces a lot of these ideas. It probably just depends on who you are and why you're coming to this text. So if you are kind of an academic that's interested in this idea of faith without belief or a theologian, I'm far from the first person to propose this. And there's a lot of philosophers out there that are thinking about this, Jonathan Quambig being a recent example. But there are Kevin Kinghorn actually at Asbury has a great book on the decision of faith that explores some of these themes. But those are more academic books. So if you're interested in the conceptual idea or the theological idea of faith without belief, those would maybe be a good place to start. But if you're like an honest seeker thinking, is Christianity for me? I would probably point you in other directions. Good apologetics book. The Ben Myers book on the Apostles' Creed is quite good. Thinking about how we structure our lives around the ordain or the mundane, the ordinary or mundane, something like Tish Harrison Warren's The Liturgy of the Ordinary was good. But I also, at the end, recommend a few fiction books or movies because I recognize the role of our imaginations in shaping our desires in certain directions. So that would be off the top of my head, but there's a longer list at the end of the book if people are interested.
Yeah, that's good. Well, Derek, this has been a lot of fun. So I'm remind everybody who's listening, go check out a copy of the book. I'll link to it as well. And then check out, if you're in Kentucky or somewhere near there, check out the work at the Lewis House. I feel like you guys are always doing some really cool events. So I would keep on the lookout for that if you're in the area. I know we've got a lot of, I'm able to see to some degree where people are listening. Like city locations, and Louisville is always one of those top places. So I think we've got a good Kentucky contingent who are listening. So you guys are nearby. So check out the Lewis House and find out the work that they're doing and see if you can support in different ways.
Yeah, and I would just say a lot of our stuff's online as well. So we have a lecture series. And for people at Louisville, we had Jonathan Pennington come last year. So we've got a good Louisville connection, good Southern connection as well. So yeah, I'd love to see some people out.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Derek. This has been a lot of fun, and everybody's been listening. Thanks for listening to the only Analytic Baptist and Confessional podcast on the planet, and we'll talk to you all soon.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound packs of juicy Kroger red, green, or black seedless grapes for $3.99 with your card and a digital coupon. Then get 1-pound packs of flavorful Private Selection 80% Lean Angus ground chuck for $4.99 each with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.